Hey everybody, Chris Fafalius here. If you enjoy One Hit Thunder, which I'm assuming you do considering you're listening to it right now, I want to tell you about another great music podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. It's called Riffs on Riffs. On this season of Riffs on Riffs, hosts Toby Braswell and Joe Watson are breaking down one iconic pop song each week. Everything from Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer to Journey's Don't Stop Believin' to Naughty by Nature's OPP. Each week, they crack open the song, trace its history, decode those cryptic lyrics, and unearth the hidden gems in its musical DNA. Not only do they dive into the song's history, lyrics, and impact, they also go down some fun and oftentimes hilarious rabbit holes. So yeah, if you're a fan of One Hit Thunder, I think you'll also enjoy Riffs on Riffs. So go hit that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Yeah, we got free tickets to the Brand Van concert happening this Monday night at the Pacific Palisades. Well, you can all in if you want to answer a couple of questions. Mainly, what is Todd's favorite cheese? Jackie just called it.
This week, we're welcoming back a one-hit thunder favorite, indie rap sensation Spose. He has brought with him the deepest cut we've discussed in ages, Brand Van 3000's Drinking in L.A., a song that soared in Canada but made only a small ripple in the States. Yet, for Spose, hailing from Maine where the song's melodies permeated the airwaves, it left an impression on him that remains even decades later. Join us as we give this song a ring-a-ding-ding and decide if more people should have taken a ride in the Brand Van.
One hit is all you need to make the money guaranteed, and you can live off royalties forever.
And it makes me wonder, is it just a wonder, or is it one hit thunder?
So Spose, welcome back to the show. Thanks for bringing a song I've never heard of in my life before, but I assumed that the reason why you knew this song and I didn't was because you were closer to Canada than I am. But then I looked at a map as to where Wells, Maine is in comparison to Montreal. And I realized, like, I'm just as close to Montreal in Pittsburgh as you are. So I don't know how you knew this song. Maybe give us a little explanation.
Yeah. Did you get much music in Wells, Maine or something?
Wow. There's just so many questions to answer in that alone. So first of all, super stoked to be back with you guys.
Hell yeah.
And I look forward to doing it again next year with some even more obscure song, as you have none left that are that have not been covered.
It is. I mean, this is noteworthy, suppose. Like, usually one of us knows the song from previously before the guest picks it. This is definitely the first time where both Chris and I are like, and then listening, I was like, maybe I'll hear it and I'll remember it. No.
Nothing. Wow.
Song is great, though. I will say this song is awesome. But
thanks. So first of all, I don't know that my regionality closeness to Montreal has much to do with me knowing this song so much, as I think they were signed to Capitol Records.
Yeah.
After it becomes, this is just from Wikipedia, because I'll be honest, I didn't know anything about this band beyond this song,
right?
Because I never bought the album. And if you, and back in whatever era it was, you didn't, 98, I think, 97,
yeah,
you didn't know anything. All you knew about an artist was what you saw on the video or the music video or buying the album. So I know this song because of 94.3 WCYY, which is the alt rock station in my region. And I think you guys probably know all the songs you know because of a station in your area.
Yeah.
I think we established last time. And so this was a hit. This was like a hit on that station around the same time as, I want to say, like, Razor Blade Suitcase era Bush and, like, you know, like, the Ixnay on the Hombre Offspring, you know, era, like the darker follow-up album era.
I mean, this had to have been something because, like, when I was doing research for it, I found them performing the song live on MTV, and it wasn't like MTV Euro or anything. Like, it was American MTV, them doing a live performance, and it was, side note, awesome live.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, look it up. The girl who sings the hook in this, Stephanie, I believe it's pronounced Morai. She's the star of this track as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed.
And then I found a really interesting video on YouTube that was about how, because it was 1997, Geffen or Capitol, whichever record label they were on, actually intentionally kept her off of all of the marketing and promotional material and considered having a white woman re-record her chorus and bridge because some test group said, oh, she sounds too urban to the rest of the song.
Wow. Holy shit.
And it's like, and that caused like a little bit of a rift between her and the rest of the group. Now they're like all buddy-buddy and do shows together again. But that was like, to me, it's like you take her out of the song, you barely have a song anymore. Like, she is the best part of the song.
Right. She crushes this hook. And to be honest, my understanding of this band, because I don't know if I'd ever seen them or whatever, I didn't know if it was a duo. I didn't know if she was the group. I didn't know what it was. But in my research leading up to this episode, I've listened to the album that this came off of, Glee, which I had seen at, you know, Newbury Comics and like Best Buy and all in this era. And I recognized the cover. I just never bought it. I didn't know what this group was. And so that, and I think the record label probably knows that. They're like, people don't know who, what. So it's like, you could switch out and replace. And when you, and as somebody who did have one hit on a big major label, you would have probably done whatever the major label said because your big one hit is the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, so here's something that's really interesting. So this group, Brand Van 3000, actually entered into a contest in Canada to get a record deal, and they tied for first, and then it was decided that they were going to be disqualified because the final round involved a live performance and there was no live band for them.
Wow.
To bring to the show. So it was like a radio contest up until the final round. And then they're like, wait, you don't have a band?
You can't perform. And yeah.
From the video that I was watching about the history of this band, they were saying like, it was these two dudes who just were like having fun making these songs. And they would just bring in any musician friends that they had to sing on tracks. And they said like, when they started doing live shows, it could be anywhere from 3 people on stage to like 15 people on stage. Like, there were times where they would just see a street performer in the city that they were playing and just be like, hey man, come on stage with us and play drums or whatever. Like, they just were like a collective, like, let's just make music and the fun of making music together. But that also, that ethos also makes it really hard to write a lot of pop songs that people want to play on the radio.
right, exactly. And maybe that's why this band will probably only get covered on One Hit Thunder, you know, or the history of Canadian music or whatever. No, that's really interesting. And as I listened to the album, I kind of figured out that like, oh, I don't know if you guys know this maybe was a better thing to cover on this episode, but do you know the song Since I Left You by the Avalanches?
Oh.
It's like a 2000.
Well, so we did a Frontier Psychiatrist as a Halloween episode of by the Avalanches.
Okay, yeah. So Frontier Psychiatrist is what I meant, actually. Yeah. Not obviously the album's fantastic.
Yeah.
The whole album Since I Left You, but the vibe I kind of got listening to this Brand Van 3000 album is almost like another album I would compare it to is like Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys, where it's like a Dust Brothers like amalgamation of almost like Odelay also by Beck, where it's like the music is made up of all these different sound collage, little drum breaks and like pieces, a lot of the way the Beastie Boys would create as well. And I think the difference is a lot of that stuff is very sample-based, and this is too, but I think a lot of it is like almost making samples out of whoever they know.
Yeah, and when I look at who they opened with at the top of their popularity, that kind of syncs up with what you're talking about, because they were opening for groups like Massive Attack, Bjork, Pulp, and Moby. So like that like sample-heavy techno... Usually,
trip hop's the word, you know.
Yeah,
it's like that.
Pulp's
that
kind
sub-genre.
Of the odd man out in that list, honestly. But.
Right, but as I mean, to be honest, man, especially you know, and I feel this a little bit today as like a, it's a little different today, but in in modern music, you know, you kind of are whose Pandora you show up on, or like who yes. the similar artists are when you listen on Spotify. Like if I tell my like Apple HomePod to play a song, it'll play a song it thinks I like because of that song after.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and so to be grouped with Massive Attack and Bjork and all these like really dope artists as an opener is the kind of 1997 version of that. And that's great. I think it's probably great for them. It's just I just assume they never followed it up. Like their next album's like 2006 or something.
Yeah, it took a while. The start of this band, Chris, did you find anything on the start of this band? Because I found this very humorous.
Well, there was the guy with the French name, right? Who was like a solo artist. And
yeah, James DeSalvio, I think it is.
No. The different.
Oh, the other one, EP.
No,
EP
not him
Bergen?
Either. Not him either. Oh. I'm talking about Jean Leloup.
Yes, it does start with Jean Leloup.
Yeah, oui, oui.
Je pense que Jean Leloup.
Jean Leloup. That's because EP went to help him on his song, and he sung in all French.
It actually starts even before that.
Okay.
The beginning of this was that James DeSalvio got a big royalty check for a remix that he had done for another Canadian artist. And he was friends with EP and basically called him up and was like, hey, you want to go to New York and spend the entirety of this check?
Okay.
Wow. And they just.
That was John and Leloup. That was the John Leloup song. It was a song called Johnny Go. And and that song went to number one on the Quebec charts.
Blowing it up in Quebec.
Yeah, charts.
They just, I guess, partied in New York and taught each other how to use samplers and turntables and started creating what would be like the beginning of this group. But they didn't start making the music until 96 is when they made a list of demos that had Drinking in LA on it. The song Couch Surfer and the song Everywhere were all on this like demo that they made. And the story that I heard was actually that they went to South by Southwest in 96, 97 with that demo and that they gave it to Moby. And Moby was like, this is awesome. And he passed it on to like the record label that he was signed to at the time. And that's also probably why they got to open for Moby later on down the line. Because you don't get, Moby's not like massive, but 1997, 1998, that's about as massive as Moby was ever going to be.
In 1997, 98, Moby was massive. Pick any artist of 98, Jay-Z. You know, I don't know.
He did that Gwen Stefani song, Southside, around that time, I want to say. Like, yeah, that was right as he was. He was not, the star was not going to be any bigger for Moby than it was at the exact time that they handed him that demo.
Well, also, of this whole subgenre we're kind of talking about, which is like a little bit of electro alternative, almost like pre-EDM. You know, it was essentially, it was in the alternative genre, but we're talking about like Fatboy Slim, the Chemical Brothers, you know, shit like that. Moby was the star. Moby was the one. He wasn't the one I wanted to be the one, but he certainly was. I mean, he had the Christopher Walken video.
Fatboy Slim was doing a much better job with videos and songs for sure. But Moby had like, I don't know, like I actually liked the more.
Oh, you're right. That was a Fatboy Slim video.
Yeah, that
you're
was
right.
Weapon
I was
going to
say it was Moby, but Moby was the star. Moby was the one Eminem was dissing.
Yep. But the thing is, like, I think Moby gave a different. Like, Moby, the best songs from Moby are like the songs that I would put on if I was going to meditate for 15 minutes. It's stuff like Natural Blues or Porcelain.
Right.
Fatboy Slim is the stuff that, like, if I'm at a party, I want to hear fucking Rockefeller Skank or Praise You or Weapon of Choice. Like,
or if I'm in a shootout or a heist, I want to hear Gangsta Trippin'. that is to say, I mean, Moby. I always point out to my kids, because I have a daughter who just turned 15, and I always try to point out, because the radio station around here was giving away tickets to see Boys to Men a couple weeks ago, and she's like, "Who's that?" I go, "You do not understand."
Oh man!
I was like, "Boys to Men for like a certain 2 year span, like 94 to 96, was one of the biggest artists on earth. Like,
yeah.
Like they definitely were big before that, you know, but they, that two album, I was like, you couldn't escape Boyz II Men. Massive hit, you know, and I just tried to, they had a, I was like, they had a song with Mariah Carey that was number one for like a record number of weeks, you know.
Yeah.
But just the context of this era, she would have no idea. That, well, that's Moby was a huge artist.
It's crazy that you have that story, because literally on Friday I had an argument with I do like a once a month movie night at my house, and it's a very large age group of people. Some in like their mid-20s will come out, and some like in their 40s. I'm leaning more towards my 40s, and Boyz II Men came up from two of the people that come that were originally grew up in LA, and they said, yeah, I think people just care about Boyz II Men here because they're from Philly. Like, they weren't really that popular anywhere else.
What?
And I was like, bullshit.
What?
I was like, absolute, no. Total bullshit.
That's like, crazy, yeah. To me. Boyz II Men, I honestly suppose, I thought you were going to say, I mean, I would think that even 15-year-olds would know all about Boyz II Men.
They might know the songs, but not know the artists. Like, I'm sure if they heard I'll Make Love to You, they'll be like, oh, I've heard this in a movie once.
I guess to me, Boyz II Men never went away. Boyz II Men has been part of my life soundtrack.
They're playing in Wells, Maine next week.
Well, yeah, all right. I mean,
they're playing in Boston, to their credit, but we're pretty close to Boston. But I think that genre of legit. I was explaining this too. I was like, the genre of legit R&B sex slow jam,
mm-hmm.
is not really on hit radio anymore.
No,
like that genre was huge. Along, it would be like, and I was telling Lily, I love that genre, by the way.
Me
love
too.
Like Keith
I was gonna
Sweat.
Say that's Chris's like I'll deep make, cuts.
Yeah. Oh my god! I was listening to "You're Making Me High" by Toni Braxton. Is one of my favorite songs ever, and I was playing it, and my daughter was like, "This was on the radio," and I was like, "Yeah, right after like the Spice Girls' Wannabe."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like it's like the
really blow her mind and play her next is too close.
Too close. Yeah, I won't. I won't. Unfortunately, I feel like that's happening in real life at the dance. So yeah, I just feel like there's a lot in this era that kind of gets swept under the rug, and I'm curious about the context of the '90s stars to, you know, this generation that didn't live through it, because it's, you know, you don't know Moby and you don't know Boyz II Men was huge, and you don't, you know, there's all sorts of artists that maybe fall, you know, by the wayside. You do know about Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. Mm-hmm. You know about maybe Eminem came, you know about Nirvana.
Right.
But like, what else do you take away? Spice Girls?
Well, even something that was hitting me with this song is even looking at the lyrics are so in a very established 1997 time and place reference point that, like, I think if you played this for any kid, they would not get references like a mafioso story with a twist, a Tu Wong Fu Julie Nemore hitch. Like, they're not going to know about the movie Tu Wong Fu.
I mean, I'm going to be honest, man, and this maybe is something I've realized a lot lately, is I have no idea what people are saying.
That's
like, I never looked up the lyrics to this, never cared to even... I did not care what they meant. Like, I sang whatever I thought the approximation of the lyrics was, and you know what, I do this with like the Smashing Pumpkins, which is my favorite band. Like, I don't know what the hell he's saying sometimes,
dude.
I don't care.
I really love the song Tonight. I've said that it's possibly the best song of the entire 90s in my eyes, and it was only a couple years ago that I even knew what the words to that song were, but it just gave me a vibe of like, I like what this is about without reading the lyrics. Like, I can just feel that it's about something special.
Right.
This is not about anything special. This is literally, it is what it says it's about. It's about getting drunk in LA.
I want to say that my first impression of this song, which I do like the hook a lot. The hook
is amazing.
The hook's great. But the rest of the song is kind of a mess. It's kind of like, what is going
on? It's like a freestyle. It's like a rap freestyle. Well, but you know what drew me to it in this era of trip hop, where it's essentially alternative with singing, but usually with turntable scratching and maybe a drum break, because a lot of it is informed by the technology of the time, because this is all pre, really, you can make music on your computer.
Yeah.
You know, this is all like physical, you know, devices still at this point, but the rapping is what really drew us. If I could make a comparison as to what, and maybe you guys have done a Maybe you guys have done an episode about this song. Maybe you guys don't even know this song, because I don't fucking know if you don't know this song. But Scooby Snacks by Fun
yes,
Loving Criminals.
Great song. We haven't done it yet, but that's a great song.
Oh, man, we should have done that. But the this will be a double episode then. Because this is... No, but that is the vibe
yeah.
that I always got from this. It's like some bass level rapping mm-hmm. and like a dope hook and a almost like breakbeat, or not breakbeat, but just like a drum break style hip hop song.
Well, and I think something that you said that I guess is worth bringing up again is like, yes, this is that period. You made the reference earlier to the Avalanches, and you also made a reference to Paul's Boutique. And I feel like those are both albums that, like, if you lose the context of when they made, seem way less impressive. Because, like, anybody right. with a computer can make Paul's Boutique or the Avalanches album now, but it's, like, not in 89 or 97. Like, you literally had to have every single one of those records handy and, like, right. finding the exact part that you want it to sample and loop. And, like, I remember watching, I think it's Beats, Life, and Rhyme, the documentary about A Tribe Called Quest that Michael Rapaport made. And there's a point where they're talking about how Q-Tip used to make beats as a kid, because he didn't have a record player, was that he would literally take a blank cassette tape and it would put it in his double-decker cassette tape and just play the same 5 seconds of what he wanted to sample over and over again for 5 straight minutes on a tape, and then put that into something and rap over top of it afterwards. And it's like that art form is completely gone, because now you just like copy, paste, and you've created your loop for
I
you to rap
I literally just
over
hit
top
the
of.
Button L.
Yeah,
like, I just hit L. Yeah, but you know, coming from that era, and I mean, I know you guys grew up in it too, it is wild how, I mean, even just the concept of, I was on another show, I was on a radio show I do in Friday mornings in Maine, and a couple weeks ago it was the... 25th anniversary of My Name Is by Eminem.
Okay.
And which maybe you guys remember where you were when you heard it. To me, it was like a while. I had never heard anything like this in my life, you know, and I had been listening to hip hop most of my life. And I just remember grabbing my boombox, which was a cassette CD player radio boombox, as most of us probably had in the 90s. And I grabbed a blank cassette that was probably already in there, and I hit play and record, and I put the boombox up to the TV. And I caught like the second verse.
Wow.
And I brought it on my Walkman to school to show my friends through headphones on the way to school. I was like, you gotta hear this, you know, and played it for them. But like that concept would never exist now. You know, it's like nobody would, they would just literally have a phone in their pocket, they hit record or they have the link or whatever.
Yeah,
so.
They just Shazam it and find it on somewhere else. Like, yeah. Like, and, oh, I don't know what this song is. All right. Now
and
I
so
know.
The way we consume music like that is certainly, you know, way easier and changed, but exactly the point that like the music they were making at that era was really confined to the equipment. You know, another big album of that style is introducing the DJ Shadow album, which was like a super popular, I don't know, mashup samples album. But like to do the Avalanches album we're talking about, which I think might have been like 2002 or something, but they still had to spend their whole life listening to records to even know the records to have the to yeah. what songs they want to sample. They need them in the right. same key.
It's similar and so, to like what was the DJ Swamp put out an album too? Bex DJ put out an album that had like Worship, Ring of Fire, and Worship the Robots is on it. But it's again, you're like, this is late enough into the 90s and early enough in the 2000s that he still needed to know the reference points that he was going to pull from and build out of.
Right. Like, yeah, shout out DJ Swamp, who did I did see play with Beck once back in the day. Like this whole subgenre was like a little not like spooky, but a little like almost like at night. You know, is the vibe I got as like a 12, 13 year old. I was like, this is like, oh, this is at night, you know, trip hop. You know, and another song I was thinking of was the Sneaker Pimps.
Yes, I love that
Six
song.
Six Underground, which maybe you guys have covered too. Am I pulling out all the songs I should have pulled out?
You,
right
you,
now?
You may be, but you
Scooby
know,
Scooby Snacks, Six Underground.
So let me ask you this question, suppose, because we are talking about like how one of the things that maybe didn't help this group is obviously like a pretty wide gap between albums. So it was 1997 followed by 2001 followed by 2007. Like there's these like four, five, 6 year gaps in between albums. Now, obviously, you're on here also to promote a new album that you recently put out. And I think you've seen both sides of it, right? Like, you've seen, you've been there where you can take the time between records to, like, tour the record, see what's happening. And now I feel like you're in this other era where it's like, you better be putting out new songs every couple weeks to couple months if you even want to have a chance of staying in people's overall algorithms anymore.
Right. Yeah, I mean, is when I look at something like that, like their discography where you see, you know, 3-6 year gaps, I mean, I just see personal stuff. That's person. Yeah. That's personal life, which would, in these scenarios where you probably had essentially a top 40 alternative hit or whatever, I'm sure it was some behind the scenes record label stuff, you know, and all sorts of personal stuff. And also they seem like a group that's more like a loose conglomerate rather than
like a band.
Four of us in a room together and kind of led by like a dude making beats in his room. But also this genre kind of passed them by pretty quick. Like by 2001, we were at Linkin Park and the Strokes and, you know, this was kind of done. But you know what's crazy is even if you have like a number one hit or something, like still that means like 65% of the earth has no idea who you are. You know, it's like it's a crazy thing. But basically the question you asked is like, do you feel, you know, the change, and you could have a couple years between albums, and now do you feel like you gotta release stuff constantly? And yes, I do feel like that. And I always put it like this, and maybe social media isn't the word for it. Maybe it's just our culture as a whole. But like social media, I always, as a metaphor, say is a river. You know, imagine the Mississippi River, and you're and the three of us are standing right here on the bank, maybe like 20 feet apart with everybody else all down the river, you know, for thousands and thousands of miles. And you really only see your little spot in the river. Right. Mm-hmm. And if I want to make a splash and make anybody notice, I make the best, biggest thing I can possibly do. And maybe I don't know what's big at the time. You know, when you throw it in the river and everybody's like, whoa. And then what happens 3 seconds later? It is gone.
Right. Yeah. Someone else throws in an even bigger rock into
look
the
river. Look at that. You know, sometimes I threw something in and somebody else threw something even. And then there was, for example, like a mass shooting that day. And you're like, whoa, that's a bigger splash. I got to look at that. You know, and so the attention span and the sheer, I mean, if you put Instagram sideways or Facebook sideways and you swipe it on the you know, horizontally on a table, it is a river.
That's what I was gonna say. That's literally what it is. You could work on something for months and it could be you or I or Matt could just have that thing come up and we could give it 3 seconds and be like, swipe,
right?
Swipe.
You know, even like if you liked it.
Yeah. Right.
You know, you're on to the and so you really have this very fleeting, finite thing. But the one thing I will say that's a positive change I've noticed, maybe even since my last album, which was 2001, before this one I just put out.
You mean 2021, right?
It hasn't 2020.
It hasn't been 23 years since the last album.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I did put out an album in 2001, but I'd get canceled if we heard it. Yes, 2021. Sorry, I put out this album, Get Rich or Die Ryan, and I think the only positive real change for artists, because there's been a lot of negative ones, your whole catalog is now in play.
Yeah.
Like not just the most recent thing you made, which does present you more opportunities to throw things in the river. Cause, you know, say for example, I don't know, what's an example? Like my song Nobody from my album, my 2015 album, is like one of my more popular songs, but you know, it maybe has like 2.5 million views on YouTube. And that is to say that most of the Earth's population has never heard of it whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I can repurpose a verse of that or a clip of the video and post it tomorrow, and maybe that's the first time you ever see it. And if you don't keep throwing things in the river, including the stuff that you've made in the past, which I guess my point is, in the entire history of the music industry, except for a greatest hits album, there was never a way to say, hey, look at my old stuff too.
Yeah.
You know, that this was good. I think that's just the model of the record industry is, hey, the new thing.
Right. Yeah. It benefits people who are prolific now.
Yes.
And that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
By now, I'm sure you've at least heard about Factor, but if you haven't tried it yet, let me tell you as a guy who loves it, now is the time. Enjoy stress-free dining this spring with Factor's chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes. With 35 weekly options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie, plus over 60 add-ons, you'll stay fueled and feel fantastic all day long. Don't wait. Fuel up for your spring goals today with Factor. Factor offers you chef-prepared meals ready in just 2 minutes so you can spend more time doing what you love this spring. Indulge in gourmet options like filet mignon, shrimp, and fresh veggies without the hassle of prep or cleanup. Customize your weekly meals to fit your schedule perfectly and enjoy the convenience of Factor's no-fuss, no-mess approach. Plus, you can celebrate Earth Day all month long with Factor's low-carbon footprint options. Factor is your go-to solution for fast, premium meals, eliminating the need for cooking and empowering you to savor every moment. So head to factormeals.com/onehit50 and use the code 150 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code 150, the words one hit and the number 50, at factormeals.com/onehit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Put down that smartphone and listen to me. I'm Matthew Milligan, professional musician and lifelong Weird Al fan. Each week, I'm joined by professional podcaster and close personal friend, Matt Kelly, to take a dive off the deep end into the vast career of pop culture icon Weird Al Yankovic on our show, Weird Algorithm. Along with some very special guests from the worlds of music and comedy, we tackle every song, every television appearance, and every bit of sketch comedy Al has produced in chronological order, covering the good old days of My Bologna and Eat It, the fun zone of Tacky and White and Nerdy, and everything in between. As we go, we're ranking the songs, albums, and music videos in the hopes of creating the ultimate guide to a career bigger than the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota. So the next time you're having one of those days stuck in a traffic jam wondering why does this always happen to me, just kick off your sneakers and stick around for a while because we've got it all on Weird Algorithm, available wherever you get your podcasts. And now you know. Was that enough references?
If I could give you another example of the gift and the curse of this, though, is James Blake, the kind of like ethereal keyboardist singer, kind of went on a rant. I hate to call it a rant. He had a monologue on X, Twitter, whatever Twitter's called, yesterday, and he said something. He was talking about TikTok and he was talking about Spotify and basically that the music industry's broken. And he goes, remember when my Godspeed cover went viral? I think it was a cover of a Frank Ocean song. He goes, neither me nor Frank Ocean ever made a cent because it was an quote-unquote original sound in every video. Oh. As in, it never was like Godspeed cover by Frank Ocean, right, or by James Blake of Frank Ocean. It just says original sound.
Right.
And so not only did they not make money off it, the average whatever teenage girl who might have been a fan of that sound or that song doesn't even know who made it.
Yeah, you're right. That sound is the right way to put that.
That sound. She's a fan of that sound. She's not even a fan of that song. It's the 11 seconds of the song, the sound. And so that is to say, you can have a gigantic viral moment. Like, I could have this chorus of one of my songs become like a viral thing that everyone in the world is posting, but unless they tagged me and the song, you don't even really know what it is. And so you can have these viral moments that don't even translate to a bigger moment, or the catalog research that you talked about.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a sound that I'm a fan of on TikTok.
Yeah.
It's, a sound that people use a lot of times. And it's when I first signed on to TikTok, it was one of the first things I became a fan of a few years ago. And it's used a lot when they show like a picture of a cat looking real cute and like coming around the corner or something. But it's this song that goes, "Here comes the boy. Hello, boy." It's like a song. I don't know who sings it. It's like a pretty good like 15-second clip, but it's exactly what you're saying.
And you saying, "I don't know who sings it," is exactly it. You know, yeah, it's like, you right. don't know. So yeah, that it's definitely so to circle back to your question, yeah, who the fuck knows what to do as far as how much you need to put stuff out. But I do think the small positive of this decreasing attention span, social media is a river concept, is that everything you've ever made is back in play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like and honestly, that. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong, man? Yeah. That's the album. If you Google it, if you were to Google it, you would see that is a Spose album. But who's going to put in that effort?
Spose, I was going to ask you, I want to talk about Brand Van, or a.k.a. BV3.
BV3K.
Great abbreviation. Love it.
Sounds like a boy band.
BV3. They call themselves BV3. When we were coming into this episode, and I wasn't familiar with Brand Van 3000, but then I listened to it. Then I listened to your new album, and I was thinking to myself, wow, is this an influence on Spose? I guess they really weren't. You kind of only knew this song too, but I could see there's a sort of eclecticness within, you know, the BV3 album. And then when I listened to your album, I'm like, maybe this was an early influence for him. Because, hey, man, I got to tell you, I really like your album. Today's the first time.
Thank you.
I got you sent the advance over. By the time this is out, your album's already out. Is that right?
Yeah.
Correct. But I sent you guys the early SoundCloud
advance
link.
Yeah. It's great. And I had some things to tell you about it. Now, anyone out there, go check it out. What Could Go Wrong from Spose. Hey, Matt and I both love the opening track. No complaints.
Oh, thank you.
It's rocking.
That's my big Pumpkins influence there. Or maybe
I said Weezer. I thought the guitar tone has a Weezer sound to it almost.
Sure, I'll take that. Oh, the heavy Weezer for sure. Thank you. I really appreciate that, because that I wanted to come out the gate with that vibe and establish that, like, this is, honestly, I feel like that song's the closest I've ever got to like the center of the Spose box, which is this kind of alt rock with lyricism bars. You know.
I mean, I think this is kind of like a little bit of behind the scenes, and you might not even necessarily know this, Spose, but the first time I ever had an interaction with you on the internet, bringing it back to like what we were talking about with like knowing reference points, it was when Self Help first came out.
Oh, okay.
You released the single for Self Help, and I think at that time I was still on Twitter, and I tweeted at you and said, "Is the ending of this inspired by Salvation by Cranberries?"
I love that song. Because
it had that banana, banana. And you were like, "Dude, how do you know that song?" And ever since, we've kind of stayed in touch, and I was able to get you on the show like a year or two after that. But sometimes it's like that hidden language of like knowing what people's reference points are helps like build that communication better, because you're like, okay, this person knows this point of contact, so I know I can have a conversation for longer than 5 minutes with this person just solely based on they know what the hell I'm talking about right now. I'm not talking over their head.
You knowing Salvation by the Cranberries is a hint that, oh, maybe we have a lot more in common than that if you're there for the kind of
like what,
that song was
cut.
Not Zombie. You know, that
it's not like Dreams. It's not Linger. It's not, yeah.
Right,
it was like
the
last noteworthy radio single they ever had.
Right. But I think I probably said this to you at the time, but I listen to that song all the time. I put that. Yeah. That's one of my favorite songs. So yeah, that song fucking rips. But
Spose, speaking of songs that rip, 15 years was 15 shaking
years.
Shaking my whole room. That sub bass in that song, fucking sick. Dude, I don't know if the way that you're releasing this album, if you have, in quotes, a single, but if you do, is Floor the single?
Oh, man, good question. So Floor is absolutely, you know what, this is some behind the scenes baseball, but basically I've released three singles leading up to this, and I wanted to release another one the week before the album dropped, but for some reason there's some thing with Spotify where if I release the single within 7 days of the album, the single won't ever show up in anybody's email, just the album. And so it's more important for me that the album shows up, but Floor is supposed to be that right before the album single, because that song is big.
Yeah, I feels love that big. Song. Love that. I mean, I was just really impressed with how, you know, eclectic. I'll use that word again. The album is the synth poppiness of that song, Make It Out Alive, I thought was awesome. I thought Brightside was really awesome.
And I got to shout out Blankets. Blanket is fucking awesome too. Blanket Thank was you. One of the ones where I like, because I had it on while I was like making lunch before we record it, and Blanket was one where I like stopped and was like, I need to write down what the song title is.
Nice. Yeah. And that one, I will say, Weezer is definitely a jumping off point for that. But to circle back to your earlier point, man, about if you know something like Brand Van 3000 would inform the eclecticness of this album. Obviously, I didn't know the Brand Van album, but listening to it, it clearly is very diverse, but I do think growing up listening to things like the Beastie Boys, growing up, even if you go listen to a Smashing Pumpkins album, which is my main influence growing up, is like, you know, there's like four or five different genres of rock music on every Pumpkins album.
The simple answer is we all grew up in the 90s, so we love this.
And so does most of the people who listen to One Hit Thunder. So if you're listening to this podcast, you're most likely a 90s fanboy, and Spose might be your new favorite rapper, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I do think it appeals to, you know, it's really, and as I get older, I get closer and closer and closer to artistically being 10-year-old me. I mean that in like the best way possible. Like, I am purely my influences and purely like unafraid to say what genuinely I feel, you know, and I think on this record, musically as well, you know, I think, and there, even if you get to the end, towards the end, there is some, you know, Chemical Brothers type break beats on any minute, you know, some like, you know, a guitar with like a harmonic on it, you know, that opens and closes the album. And like, it's,
I heard some acoustic guitars on here. I heard all kind of stuff.
I also love that you pulled a Taylor Swift deluxe edition trick of just having a voice memo of you hashing out one of the tracks in
as
the middle
a song.
Of the album.
Well, and that comes from my friend Ben's Been Dead, who is featured on Make It Out Alive and Brightside. He kind of sat down with me because I really had made this album in almost real time as I was going through divorce from my wife. And so I was, you know, I started this album before anything went wrong. And then we find out what could go wrong, and I go through it kind of in real time. And so the album is mostly in chronological order from when I started, when I made it, and when I finished it. And so my friend Ben had pointed out, as we're listening to maybe 20 or 30 demos that are, you know, tracks I'd made, and some of it were like, no, that's too deep, that's too personal, don't put that out, or that's, that just doesn't fit the vibe. He kind of like executive produced, I guess, in a way, that song, the voice memo song. He go, because I had a fully produced version of that with like a full band, and he goes, man, the voice memo demo of that is raw as hell. Like, that would be crazy if you just put that on there. So shout out to Ben for that encouragement to just put basically me playing a guitar, singing that demo from a raw personal place. But thanks, man. And I think eclectically, I do think it covers all these new spaces. And you talked about self-help earlier, which I was happy to put out a few years ago to expand the box of what you think Spose could be to this punk rock tempo aggression thing. And I think on this album, having already established that, I'm like, all right, I feel safe in all these genres in a way.
I do have to ask before we wrap this up, is there going to be a tour coming up soon to promote the new album?
Yes, I'm announcing it in like sections, and by the time people hear this, the first section will be announced. So you could go to sposemusic.com and look at those dates. But I'm definitely trying to do the whole country throughout the year and go play these records and you know, and the quote unquote hits and get back to. I haven't been on tour since 2022, so yeah. I'll be stoked.
Well, I can say that I've only seen Spose once, and it was probably, I'm willing to guess it was during one of the most uncomfortable sets you've ever played in your entire life, and you still killed it, so I can't wait to see.
Good.
To see, yeah,
I hope
more.
You come to a good one. Yeah. Yeah,
I saw you play, do you remember when you had to play the Too Many Games video
oh my
game
God,
convention?
Top, yo, I've read, so this is real, yeah, I fucking do. I sent the meanest email ever after that show. I was so pissed. Entirely not worth it. I wish I could have that the weekend back.
It was a hell of a show. I bought every shirt that you had available in your merch table at that show. But
well, you're appreciated. The sound guy, no.
And yeah, the, no, that was a wild... That was an... Chris, to give you some... to give you a view of what was happening here... It was literally a family-friendly video game convention, okay. And it was, like, right before him, like, our buddy Megaran went on and, like, did a great job, and Megaran's got that whole video game thing happening, and I went, because obviously I'm friends with Megaran, but I love Spose. I was like, I can finally see Spose live, and I think he hit the stage, and... What would you say? Like halfway through it, you realized I say fuck a lot in these songs where there's just a gang of children in the front row.
And like my wife at the time and like our kids are all there because I was like, oh, we'll go to Philly for like a little trip, you know. And, but the main thing I remember is the sound guy kept interrupting the show because of his equipment, which was janky.
Yeah.
And sheesh. Broken, like he had a mic stand that would not stay up, and so I was like reefing on it, and I think I like dropped it at one point because it's like this is a piece of shit from 10 years ago. And he stops, he comes on the mic like in the monitors and like starts yelling at me in the middle of the show. It was awful.
It was killing me.
Yeah, no, it was
horrible.
But I was in the front row pushing those kids over, singing along to "Knocking on Wood." Like
my man. It was like Curb Your Enthusiasm. I always talk about this hypothetical. If I ever have the time or the energy to write like a HBO series about being a touring musician called Vanimals, nobody steal this, please. And basically each episode is a city. That episode would be like whatever town outside of Philly that's called. It says it on the screen in text.
I mean, that's a hell of an opening. That's a first episode opening is that show.
Oh, I've got way better than that. But yeah, essentially the show, you never see us perform because all the drama of the day is everything else. Maybe that show you'd see part of the performance, but it's like a band that you never hear in the show, you know?
Yeah, and so, the band from Can't Hardly Wait, Love Burger. Just Love Burger. You never hear a song by the band.
Right, exactly.
I've had plenty of these. I've once played at a gazebo in Mississippi in a swarm of mosquitoes.
I've been to all
these shows.
I think anybody who's been a touring musician for as long as both you have, you have war stories to share.
You really do. I mean, I could go off. I mean, I know we're trying to get out of here, but I have, for example, there's one episode that would be just Salt Lake City. And it starts in Salt Lake City, but by 10 minutes in, it's Logan, Utah. Because they moved the show from Salt Lake City to Logan, Utah, and we're like, all right. And then they move it from the venue in Logan, Utah to the what I thought was a club called like Eagles Club. No, it's just the Eagles Club. Like where old people go to drink, and nobody told them we were coming there to play a show. Sound equipment, none. You know, it's like everything just went. And then when the promoter realized that, like, oh, I really screwed this up, and like I owe Spose actually like $2,500 right now, he disappeared. We couldn't find him, so we had to drive back to Salt Lake City and stand outside his office the next morning, like to shake him down for like the money. So yeah, touring sucks.
Hey, Spose, suppose you would really enjoy, if you go on YouTube, look up the singer from Green Jello hunting down a promoter who stiffed him, finding him, and then humiliating him on camera for like 20 minutes straight. That guy's wild. You would enjoy that video.
I'm typing it in right now. So yeah, that yeah. But
before we wrap up, I do have like some Brand Van 3000 things to talk about with you guys pretty quick. Apparently, Brand Van was the 131st biggest band in Canada from 1996 to 2006.
Ranks that?
Well, I'll tell you. It was based on... So, in 2017, Nielsen and Billboard, in honor of 150 years of Canada existing, they were figuring out who were the 150 biggest bands and artists from Canada of all time, based on the data they had, which was SoundScan and digital from the years 1996 to 2016. So based on that, they were 131. Now, I had a little game for you guys to see. Do you know who number one would be? Who the number one artist?
Ooh, yes. Okay, you go with your answer, and I think I have another one if you are wrong.
This is the number one Canadian artist?
The number one Canadian artist of all time, based on data between 1996 and 2016. Physical and digital sales, according to Nielsen and Billboard.
Oh, to 2016?
Yeah.
96 to 2016. The number
one. I was real confident, and now I'm not. Celine Dion is who I was
going
to say.
Is that who you're going with? Who are you going with, Matt?
Well, at first I thought you were saying band, like specifically a band, which I think it would be Bare Naked Ladies. But I
band
think
or artist.
Band or artist. I feel like Justin Bieber, right? He's Canadian, and that would have been like his prime time.
Spose, don't say another guess because you got it.
Yes.
I'll tell you in order if you want to know. Now, Matt,
Shania
Twain was number two.
Yeah.
That's good job.
I didn't know Shania Twain was Canadian. God damn. Yeah.
That's what I'm here for.
Matt, if you would have said band, you would have still been wrong because the biggest band...
The Tragically Hip.
You got it. God damn, yeah. Spose.
What can't I do?
How are you this good at this?
I just live in Maine, very close to Canada, I guess.
Okay. All right. Well, the list was Celine Dion was one, Shania Twain two, Bublé three.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Michael.
Yeah. Tragically Hip four, Sarah McLachlan five, Nickelback six, Diana Krall, I don't know who that is, seven, yeah. Avril Lavigne eight, Our Lady Peace nine, Bryan Adams 10, Justin Bieber was 11.
Damn, that's crazy to me, but okay. Yeah.
Then it went Leonard Cohen, Neil Young, Blue Rodeo, Bare Naked Ladies, finally down here at like 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then here's something that's really surprising to me. Then it was Great Big C, Johnny Reed, don't know who either of them are. Then Alanis Morissette, all the way at 18.
No way.
So let me ask a question,
it's
though.
Because Jagged Little Pill came out in 95.
That may have been it. Yeah.
Well, I was also going to ask, I'm wondering if that was confined within Canadian sales versus like American crossover. Because I wonder if like Justin Bieber is one of those artists that's bigger in America than he is in Canada or something.
Probably.
You know what I mean? Like,
right. Probably.
Because I think just based on sales alone during the time period where 2016 is involved, like Bieber was inescapable for like a decade there.
I just think the reasons it's Celine Dion and Shania Twain are the sales in the 90s of CDs were way more substantial than any number of people, any number of times someone bought the single Baby by Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
You know, you're buying 12. You're buying all 12 Celine Dion songs.
That's fair.
You guys ready to test your wits one more time?
Oh,
let's
boy.
Go.
Okay,
I'm
here
ready
we go.
To win again.
Yeah, I think you might. Here we go. Brand Van 3000 is from Montreal. Name another band from Montreal. I'll tell you this. I have seven listed here that you probably know.
I mean, the Arcade Fire.
You got it. Wow. Right, okay. Well, good job. Matt, would you have gotten any?
No, my brain was falling apart, and all I was thinking of was the band of Montreal.
They are like, one of them.
They are one of them. Okay. Yeah. I thought that was like an ironic American band name.
There's another Broken Social Scene is maybe from there.
Oh, are they?
One of those Pitchforky type of bands.
I didn't see the Arcade Fire. The other bands that I was that would have counted here were Godspeed You Black Emperor, Wolf Parade, Simple Plan of Montreal, Men Without Hats, and Chromeo.
Oh, damn.
Fire coming out of Montreal.
Yeah.
That's great.
The one more question I have for you two. Brand Van 3000 were part of the Horde Tour 98. That's H-O-R-D-E, the Horde Tour.
Oh, God, we went over this already.
Name two other bands or artists that played at the Horde Tour in 1998.
The Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Oh,
no.
No, they did not play that year. That's a good guess.
I'm going to throw, because I think we talked about them on this episode, Rusted Root. Was Rusted Root on the Horde Tour?
They were not on that Horde Tour.
The Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
No.
I remember the Horde Tour. 311, I feel like, was on the Horde Tour at one point.
Not this year. Not 1998.
All right, hit me.
I'm going to throw one more out there. Indigo Girls?
No, no.
Okay.
They were probably on Lilith Fair. Sure. The Horde Tour 98 featured Blues Traveler, Bare Naked Ladies, Ben Harper and the Innocent Criminals, Alana Davis, Cherry Poppin' Daddies.
That's what I was going for.
worst band name ever.
Yeah.
Cowboy Mouth, Fastball, Galactic, Government Mule, Huffamoose, Matt, our boy's Huffamoose.
Hell yeah, our boy's Huffamoose.
Marcy Playground, Pollicle, and Spose, come on, man, the Smashing Pumpkins.
No.
Yeah?
Smashing Pumpkins are the only cool band on that list.
Oh, I disagree.
Oh, man, don't say anything bad about Bare Naked Ladies.
Yeah, I love BNL, man.
It's just the least sexy list of musicians I've ever
yeah,
heard.
It was not. It was Horde Tour would not have been where I was at. Oh, one more for you guys. Brand Van 3000 released Drinking in L.A. in February of 1997. The 39th Grammys also happened in February of 1997, where this female artist won Album of the Year for her album Falling Into You.
Oh, I know this. Buzzing in. Celine Dion. That's right off.
Celine Dion was the answer to two of my questions I had for you.
Well, finally, I was sitting there thinking 1997, that's 100% the Grammys when My Heart Will Go On was like blowing up. So
that's Titanic. Hey, one last thing that I thought was really interesting about BV3, as I like to call them. In their second album in 2001, Discosis, the single from that album, which is pretty awesome, called Astounded, it was the final recorded performance of Curtis Mayfield before he died.
What?
Curtis Mayfield sings the whole thing. I was waiting for someone else. It's basically just a Curtis Mayfield song. It became the most successful Canadian single from BV3. This Astounded song was bigger than Drinking in L.A. It reached number 3 on the Canadian singles chart. For anyone who doesn't know who Curtis Mayfield is out there, he sings Move On Up. If you don't know Move On Up, it's the song that's sampled in Kanye's Touch the Sky. That's Curtis Mayfield. That's kind of interesting. The song just straight up sounds like a Curtis Mayfield song. But I guess we're at that point in the show where we decide. BV3, did they bring the one-hit thunder or was it a one-hit blunder? I don't know.
I think they brought the thunder on this song. I think it's a really cool song. I think it's just maybe like a record label conundrum to figure out what to do with a band like that. And I can't wait to hear Astounded, but I'd say not a blunder for me.
I'm kind of torn because, you know, I like to look at it through like two different lenses of like, should this band have been much bigger? And like, are there a bunch of other songs by them that you should check out? And it's like, are there a bunch of other songs you should check out? I actually think, yes, I enjoyed listening to the album Glee and I enjoyed the Curtis Mayweather song that you were talking about.
Mayfield.
that you were talking about earlier. But the reverse of that is, should they have been bigger? I'm also kind of like, not really. Like they didn't have like they didn't have like marketable songs to put on the radio. I just like weird shit, and they made some cool weird shit. So I'm gonna say Thunder, but it's a very gentle Thunder. Like you should check out the album Glee and listen to it.
It's Thunder really in the distance.
Yes, it's rumbling it's a out there. So Chris, is it a full blown certification? Do we have to get an envelope ready?
This is a really hard one for me because we're talking about one hit Thunder, and I don't even know that this band had one hit. I'm kind of
fair.
I think that that's a strike against them, being that I don't know this song. I mean, the music video does have 4.6 million views, so it seems like a lot of people know it. I most definitely did not. I think the song is cool. I do think a couple other songs are cool. I think it's kind of a mess. Like, there's not like a real signature sound to this band. And it seems like a collective of people contributing different things. And for what it is, it achieved a certain level of success. And I think that's cool for them. Should it have had more? I think they had all the success they were going to get from BV3.
Yeah, I think that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. It went above and beyond. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even buy the album, so.
right. And I don't know. It peaked at number 35 on Canada's RPM top singles. Oh, real quick quiz for you guys before I say Thunder or Blunder. It peaked at number 35 on Canada's RPM top singles, which I guess is kind of like their Billboard or whatever in a certain way, on July 28th of 1997. What do you think the number one song was on the RPM charts at that time?
What was the date?
July 28th, 1997. If you get this, I will be so impressed.
I'm going to go 1 Week by the Bare Naked Ladies.
Damn it. That was what I was going to go with. Okay. Well, then I'm going to steal your Celine Dion answers all the time and say It's All Coming Back to Me Now by Celine Dion.
No. I think Spose was a little bit closer. It was actually The Difference by The Wallflowers.
Ooh, what a song. Yeah. That's a good-ass song.
Yeah. So when The Difference was number one in Canada, this was number 35. Sorry, I can't make this a certified Thunder. I got to go Blunder.
That's all right. International shipping for that certification to Canada would have killed us. So.
Yeah.
I would have kayaked it over the border. The social media river.
But hey, Spose, thanks for coming back, man. It's really awesome talking music with you. And I want to really reinforce, go check out Spose's new album, What Could Go Wrong. It's awesome.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. I really appreciate you checking out the album and the love and for having me back on.
I feel like the floor beneath me fell out and I hope I'm dreaming. When I wake up, I'm still in the dark. Losing us, cause I got nothing to lose. $100, so it's not even 100 proof. Could make me numb. What have we become? Grab me, babe, I'm falling. So when I slip, you were waiting to catch. But there's a catch, there's a catch, there's a catch. There's a drop, there's a fall, yeah, once and for all.
This has been One Hit Thunder. One Hit Thunder is hosted by Chris Ophalios of the band Punchline and produced by Matt Kelly of Geekscape.net. Underneath me, you're hearing Floor by this week's guest, Spose. Find it on his new album, What Could Go Wrong. Our podcast is on Patreon now. Find us at patreon.com/OHTpodcast for early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and a chance to vote on future songs for us to cover. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on any podcasting app. And tune in next week for more One Hit Thunder.
Feet in the air and I can't find no solid ground. So there I go, falling right through your ghost. Where's the rope? Get the rope. The scream is stuck in my throat. My heart is shredded.
Listening to the Geekscape Network.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room.
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.